Yom Kippur, Saturday, October 6, 1973. Israelis rush from their place of prayer at the Western Wall in Jerusalem and synagogues all over the country. The wailing sirens disrupted the sanctity of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the most solemn and sacred day of the Jewish year. And in so doing, the sirens signaled the outbreak of the fourth Middle Eastern War in just 25 years. And even now, no one knows what the final outcome is going to be. Really won the war, and what is going to become of the Middle Eastern area in the future? Well, no one really knows. The war was not won, it was lost by everybody. That includes the United States, the Soviet Union, Japan, Western Europe, because of the Arab oil cutbacks. The entire world was quickly concerned with the outbreak of hostilities in the Middle East, which could hardly be characterized as another minor conflagration between hostile neighbors. It was on Saturday, October 6th, when suddenly, caught by surprise on the holiest of the Jewish days of Yom Kippur, the Egyptians in force crossed the canal over pontoon bridges. These Egyptian films coming to us from British photographers that were on the site. The Israelis were caught off guard. They were forced to evacuate the Bar-Lev line, one of the very famous series of bunkers and deep trenches and fortifications that the Israelis had gradually built up after the Jew-Arab conflict, the Six-Day War of 1967. All of this, of course, was coordinated with a Syrian attack in the north that came deeply into the Golan Heights, and the Syrians drove to within view of the Israeli farming areas around the Sea of Galilee. So it was not just a little shooting war, but a very big one, involving perhaps up to 1,800 tanks on the parts of the Arabs, and of course a quick mobilization by the Israelis. As I said, the Syrians drove to within sight of some of the kibbutzim or the farming areas of the earlier positions they had occupied back prior to the 1967 Jew-Arab conflict, and it was only then that the Israelis began to mobilize to drive the Syrians back toward the capital of Damascus. A couple of 3 days later, we learned that the Iraqis, the Jordanians, Saudi Arabia, and others had also begun to supply troops and material. The Egyptians were merely being held by the Israeli forces in the south with 100,000 Egyptians and 1,000 tanks across the canal, while the Israelis took care of the most immediate threat deeper to their homeland, closer to Israel and its major cities, that of the threat of the Syrians deep in the Golan Heights. They drove finally to within tank cannon range of the outskirts of the city of Damascus. These Israeli films showing the capture of some Syrian soldiers and their inquisition. And a little later on, the Israelis had to learn that Syrians had apparently tortured Israeli prisoners after capturing them in the earliest skirmishes that took place in the Golan Heights area. What the Israeli reaction is going to be to this, what the private feeling of the Israeli citizens is about learning of prisoners having been tied, tortured, and then put to death, I do not right now know. I can imagine that it is one of deep bitterness, which may also have overtones in any renewed conflicts that are going to occur there. Well, what finally then began to shape up in the Sinai Desert after the Israelis had turned their attention fully upon the Syrian forces and all but liquidated the Syrian tank forces that had penetrated so deep into the Golan Heights, developed in the Sinai into one of the greatest tank battles since World War II. The Egyptians called it the greatest in history, and well, it might have been. I don't believe in those earlier days when Americans and British and others could not really find out much of what was going on in the days of all of the conflicting reports from both sides, any of us could have realized the hundreds of thousands of troops, the hundreds upon hundreds of tanks, hundreds of aircraft that were involved in this one of the greatest battles since Western Europe of World War II. The battle raged day and night, day after day, much longer than anyone thought it would, and there is no telling. Right now, as we try to appraise and assess what did occur then and get some sort of meaning about what is going to happen globally and on into the future, just how big a battle this really was. The Israelis drove a wedge quickly between the Egyptian 2nd and 3rd armies and established a bridgehead on the Egyptian side of the canal. The 3rd army appeared to be in danger of being surrounded. Here you see napalm from Israeli F-4s, and many hundreds of those F-4s were involved, and apparently over 100 of them destroyed in the first couple of days of the war. Some very new things happened, the use of many new weapons, the SAM-2s, 3s, and 6s that were used in full deployment against the F-4s supplied by the United States and flown by the Israeli Air Force that took a terrible attrition rate early in the war because, unlike the Jew-Arab conflict of 1967, the Israelis were not able to knock out the Egyptian Air Force on the ground. They didn't have the element of surprise this time, and it cost them very heavily. The Russian presence in the Middle East was not only felt in terms of the super sophisticated weapons they provided the Arabs, but also the menacing presence of a huge Russian fleet in the eastern Mediterranean area, all of them operational, all of them at sea. And, of course, for the very first time, the use of satellites in modern war, which I am convinced personally led the Russians themselves to begin screaming through the United Nations for a ceasefire when they learned, prior to the complete encirclement of the Third Army in the south, through satellites with daily film coming back to the Soviet Union, proving that this earlier incursion of Israeli tanks into Egypt was not just a diversionary move or some minor flanking movement, but an all-out thrust which could have carried the Israeli forces right into Cairo itself. It was only then that apparently the Soviet Union began to bring heavy pressure to bear to bring about a ceasefire of some sort. So what may have appeared to many Americans as being another noisome, terrible, obnoxious shooting war certainly felt deeply by hundreds of thousands of American Jews who quickly went to bat to begin to raise millions of dollars to help the beleaguered people of Israel. Another war between hostile, warring neighbors who can't get along very quickly became one of the most tense situations to occur or come along on the world scene since the Kennedy administration and the Cuban Missile Crisis, or perhaps before that at the Berlin Wall, and in many ways even bigger. And what many people don't realize is that the move that President Nixon made, of first guaranteeing that the United States would resupply Israel, and secondly placing the U.S. armed forces on alert and causing us to come right into a direct confrontation with the Soviet Union, was a move of great courage, and a move that in many ways, I believe historians will say, was of greater consequence eventually than the Cuban Missile Crisis.
While people struggled through the Depression, the Plain Truth magazine was warning about European nationalism. When everyone sighed relief at the end of World War II, the Plain Truth was predicting the Middle East crisis. When Korea dominated the headlines, the Plain Truth was forecasting the formation of the common market. When the space race captured America's fancy, the Plain Truth was covering trade war and the rise of Japan, future super giant. To keep ahead of today's world trends, send for your free subscription. Write Ambassador College, Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, BC. The Plain Truth Magazine. After 38 years, still ahead of its time.
While the Egyptians and the Arabs looked upon the earlier Arab victories, as they called them, as a fantastic vindication, almost a spiritual and a moral cleansing for the humiliation they had suffered in the Six-Day War of 1967. And while President of Egypt Anwar Sadat was received by thousands of cheering political members and members of his cabinet and citizens and the press in Cairo, meanwhile, the Israelis were busily driving deep inside Egypt, and the Egyptian press tended to discount this, as did the Egyptian military leadership. The Israelis could scarcely believe their good fortune when, even though the Syrians had a tremendous advantage all the way to the brinks of the Golan Heights, they failed to press it home. And secondly, why it was that the Egyptian army, 100,000 strong with about 1,000 tanks, once completely across and into the Sinai, abandoned some of the most basic techniques of tank warfare, that of the armored spearhead, of moving rapidly into the most strategic military areas. They thought, the Israelis did, that the Egyptians would head for those two passes as fast as they possibly could. But instead, it seemed the Egyptians were content to keep their forces completely scattered over a broad area. This gave the Israelis a fantastic and an unexpected advantage. And so they drove deep into Egypt, and it was only by the use of Soviet spy satellites and force brought to bear through the United Nations and in negotiations directly between the United States and the Soviet Union, when they agreed that the Third Army might have to surrender. And the Soviets saw in this another tremendous back-breaking loss of super-sophisticated modern Soviet military equipment to the Israelis that the ceasefire was finally bargained for. So the Russians hastily summoned Secretary of State Kissinger to Moscow to arrange for a ceasefire. You've heard of daily interruptions of this. Charge and countercharge ever since. After the ceasefire, the Third Army continued to try to break out of encirclement, and the Israelis kept tightening the noose. The map here shows what had occurred. This, the Sinai, colored in the purple, the Red Sea there in the middle of your screen, and the yellow showing the intrusion of Egyptian forces to the north across the canal, and then the Great Bitter Lakes area to the south around Suez City. The Third Army, that little enclave of yellow, you see, both around and in Suez City and also on the Sinai part. The purple over into the Egyptian side, the farthest advances, at least known in general, of the Israeli forces. Apparently, had they not been stopped by superpower intervention, the Israelis could have gone right on to Cairo. And there are many inside Israel who wish they had. I'm sure that there are many who wish they had gone ahead to completely annihilate the Third Army. Nevertheless, United States and Soviet pressure did save the Egyptian Third Army, and the Israelis were forced to allow non-military supplies, medicine, food, and water, in supply truck columns to reach them. So while the Israelis were relieved that the ceasefire did take effect finally, they were very bitter, as one Israeli soldier put it, and I quote, "The Arabs learned they could start a war whenever they wanted and then get the war stopped whenever they wanted." Where was the United Nations, the Israelis asked, during the very first days of the war when it appeared the Arabs were headed toward a victory? Why did the Soviet Union wait to intervene, the Israelis want to know, until it appeared that an Israeli armored column was about to wipe out an entire Egyptian army? Why didn't they intervene when it appeared the reverse of that in the earliest two or three days of the war? Well, whatever the global arena, the toll in lives and wounded was very, very heavy on both sides. That includes civilians and foreigners. It had been alleged that the Israelis had, as you know, in an attack on what was called the embassy and turned out to be a cultural center in the city of Damascus, had killed and injured a lot of civilians, including, the earlier report said, which proved to be false, about 30 Russians. And then a later report came out that the Israelis had, in their rapid overrunning of Syrian forces in the Golan Heights, actually captured some Russians. The Israelis have denied it. The toll in lives and wounded was terribly heavy, though. The Israelis finally reported 1,854 Israelis dead, and that proportionate to the population means that in this few days of conflict in the Middle East, the Israelis lost more fighting young men than the entirety of American war dead in Vietnam. That's on a per capita or proportionate basis. As a comparison, that means that one person out of 494 in the nation of Israel dead. And comparing this to Egypt alone, not including Syria or other allies among the Arabs, it means that in Egypt they lost one out of every 4,550. Not very encouraging from any point of view, a toll very heavy on both sides, while the Israelis fared far better in absolute numbers and scored a remarkable tactical victory again. It wasn't as swift, it wasn't as perhaps heady to them. It carries with it none of the jubilance, none of the celebration of the Six-Day War, merely because they were caught by surprise. There has been bitterness inside the Israeli high command and among some who have attacked Moshe Dayan and other members of the cabinet for their lack of preparedness. Not one of jubilation, but of bitterness inside major cities in Israel today, not only at their own high command and accusing their own leadership, but certainly a great deal of hostility now even toward the United States and other countries, even though they recognize the United States as the one biggest friend that they have anywhere in the world. Well, the big thing that began to develop very quickly, if you really look behind the news, was the Soviet involvement. The Soviet Union has tried to move year after year into the Middle East, and this goes clear back to World War II and before. Shortly after World War II, the Soviets tried what was tantamount to a military coup in what really emerged as a civil war in Greece. And it took British tanks and troops, even in 1946, to actually land in Greece and put a stop to what would have been a Soviet drive to obtain warm water Mediterranean seaports. That was thwarted. But from that time to this, the Soviets have never once relaxed their relentless intent to drive into the Middle East and gain control of the Mediterranean and thence the soft underbelly of Europe. They have a large, powerful fleet with many, many ultra-sophisticated units, nuclear-powered, as well as submarines with nuclear-tipped warheads operating in the Mediterranean Sea. They have bases all over the Mediterranean, notably among the Arab countries, certainly the big one at Alexandria, Egypt. And of course, you know that the Israelis have had to suffer these casualties at the hands of super sophisticated Russian weapons, machine guns, tanks, cannon, the SAM 2, 3, and 6s, some of them fired from fixed emplacements, some by trucks, and of course, even new weapons used this time, such as the very effective wire-guided rockets used by the foot soldiers against Israeli tanks, which took a fearsome toll in equipment and lives early in the outbreak of the new fighting. And for the first time in modern warfare, the use of Soviet spy satellites. And had it not been the use of those Soviet spy satellites and the Russians putting pressure on the United States and through the United Nations to bring a stop to the ceasefire, you and I both know, as do the Israelis, that the Israelis would have wiped out the Egyptian Third Army. And inside Israel these days, more and more people are wondering why they didn't do precisely that.
The last Apollo flight lands on the moon while religious war rages in Northern Ireland. Politicians search for peace while pollution engulfs our planet. The gross national product of the United States exceeds $1 trillion, while some 15,000 starve to death worldwide every day. In this age of paradox unparalleled, where can you turn for understanding? There is a source that answers the frightening questions of the 20th century. It's called The Plain Truth. This magazine of understanding reveals the meaning behind today's world news and shows you the good news beyond. The Plain Truth is full color, 52 pages, totally free of charge in the public interest. Today, more than ever before, you need The Plain Truth. For a free subscription, write Ambassador College, Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, BC.
Just as this newest Middle Eastern conflict broke out, I was talking to a series of live audiences in cities all over the United States and Canada, and as the news kept coming, was talking about the ultimate fantastic involvement of the big powers of the world simply because this fuse had once more been ignited and the bomb was about to explode right at the very heart and the core of the very life's blood supplies of the biggest industrial powers the world has ever known. If Arab oil were to be cut off, I told those audiences, it would hurt the United States ultimately up toward about 17 to 20%. I said 20% to some audiences of our fuel supplies. No, the government said 6%. That's all we depend upon, the Arab oil, to make up the lack of American productivity, the American fields that are even now, as Mr. Nixon has said recently, being revitalized, and also, of course, what very few people seem to realize was that though the 6% represented crude oil direct from Arab oil heads and into tankers right to United States refineries, that didn't account for the amount of refined gas and other fuels and so on, petrochemicals and other derivatives of the coal tar and petrochemical industries that were coming to us from Europe. And so, of course, maybe you kept abreast of it, maybe not, but you might have known about the two-day meetings that concluded rather fruitlessly, taking place in Vienna at about the very same time as the outbreak of hostilities in the Middle East. This between the major oil-producing Arab states and some of the leading European and Western powers. It resolved itself inconclusively with the Kuwaiti representatives going out of the meeting, calling for an all-Arab oil producers union or a meeting, which they did achieve, down in Kuwait. And it was then, finally, and in successive meetings, including a trip by Anwar Sadat in advance of Henry Kissinger's visit to Cairo, in which Anwar Sadat visited some of the leading Arab oil-producing states, to call upon Arab unity in clamping down shipments of oil not only to the United States, but to Western Europe and to Japan. The reaction of these countries is going to remain yet to be seen. The United States said, we can take it. Well, I don't know if we can or not. We're not taking it very well. Already one casualty I know of was a terrible, atrocious thing that happened in the San Francisco Bay Area, where the news had it that one man, having been denied a full tank of gasoline, became so enraged that he went home and got a shotgun and came back and simply shot the service station operator. We Americans are accustomed to having ours when we want it, and right now. We don't want to wait. And so even though the government says we can take about a 6% reduction in crude oil, ultimately meaning about a 17% reduction in these energy sources, including the plastics industry, vinyl, many other areas that were being hurt in, which has even affected the automotive industry, and many other companies of all sorts and types. One small city I heard of where a chemical plant manufacturing vinyl was located had something like 9,000 people, I believe, laid off in one single day. Now, that's a staggering blow to the economy of any small town of about 50,000 people or so. It's beginning to happen in our country. We're beginning to see a clamp down in fuel. We may have to go to wartime rationing as a result of it. But let's just think for a minute that if it begins to hurt the United States, and it is hurting, what does it do to Europe and to Japan? Western Europe, Euromark, some people have called it, the common market, others have called it, what I feel is not necessarily in the confines of European Economic Community, but certainly there is going to emerge in Western Europe a third power bloc. They now talk about the five big power blocs. This is going to be a major world power comprised eventually of 10 nations. But they depend there for the very life's blood on Middle Eastern oil producers for up towards 96% of their energy demands. The refineries all across Holland or the Netherlands, in Germany, in southern France, all over those European countries are fed with the crude oil that comes on a daily stream from the Middle Eastern wellheads. And they come around and circumnavigate Africa in the huge Japanese super tankers that are more than 100,000 tons dead weight and the like. And those, by the way, are so big that there is not a single eastern port in the United States of America that can accommodate one of them. The refineries, though, are beginning to find themselves operating at somewhat less in capacity. And, of course, the Dutch people had to have that one driveless Sunday. Now, you can admire some of those people for doing what they needed to do instantly, where in the United States it seemed like we dragged our feet way beyond all reason. Nobody seemed to take governmental warnings seriously. President Nixon would say, we're going to face an energy crisis, and some reporter would say, yeah, but now about your house in Key Biscayne. Yeah, but now about those two tapes, Mr. Nixon. And everybody immediately began, not everybody, but a few people began to say, well, Mr. Nixon probably created this alert only as a lot of smoke in the air because he wants to get the heat off of Watergate. Well, I think historians will finally have to resolve that for us. I think finally someone is going to wake up and realize in this country that what has been happening in the Middle East, as we have been saying on a World Tomorrow program on radio, in the pages of the Plain Truth magazine, and on this series of television programs for these many years, when I have said publicly, and many of you have heard me say publicly, that the Middle East and Europe is finally going to so dominate your concern, so occupy your headlines, and so make deep inroads into your own private daily way of life, that it is going to pale into insignificance, American concern during the Vietnam War. Maybe we don't realize, too, that loss of prestige abroad as a result of Watergate and as a direct result of both the communications and the credibility gap between American leadership and the American people, the calls for the impeachment or the resignation of President Nixon, the resignation of a vice president, the agonizing and in some ways bizarre hearings into the last little thing, the charges by newspapers completely unfounded about Gerald Ford and his past business dealings, the allegations, suspicion here and there and the other place. I'm going to tell you, has meant more because I have been to Europe, I've talked to leaders there since all these things began to happen. I'm going to tell you this, and it's the truth. that this picking away at leadership, this destruction of confidence in American leadership, has done more damage to the United States of America abroad than the combination of the Gary Powers U-2 incident during the Eisenhower administration, the Pueblo incident, the Bay of Pigs disaster, and 10 solid years in Vietnam all put together. The loss in confidence on the part of American leadership by Western Europe and Japan alike are even now beginning to take their toll in global geopolitical moves. The big thing that began to happen in the Middle East was when those Kuwaitis got their way, had that conference, and the Arab oil producers began to agree that they were going to use Arab oil as a weapon against those who would supply Israel. But they began to carry it several steps further. And not only were they using it as a weapon against the United States and countries friendly to the United States who were also, such as the Netherlands, friendly to Israel, but they decided to begin to cut down and to raise prices at the same time, and that began to affect not only the United States of America, but the huge supergiant of Japan and the growing economic power of a, at least economically united, Western Europe, the common market. Now, those people are not necessarily constrained to react in the face of world public opinion with the agony of 10 years of Vietnam on their record in the same way that the United States might be expected to react. Japan, if she loses Arab oil, Japan dies. I doubt that they're willing to do it peaceably. If Europe loses, as they are, Arab oil, even 10%, 11% of it, they begin to strangle. The United States hurts, and hurts badly. But Europe strangles, and Japan dies. I was telling these live audiences, as I will tell this television and radio audience, I believe you are going to see a call to arms in many of these countries. I believe you are going to see the beginning of the creation of a new, big military force conversant with the size and the scope of the economic force of Japan, of West Germany, and of Israel. And I believe the renewed hostility in the Middle East and the moves on the Arab oil producers is absolutely catalytic to those trends and conditions you're going to see. Well, we've got two more programs coming along on what all this means: the oil stoppage, the energy crisis, the entire global picture of just what the new Middle Eastern conflict means to you and to yours in the months and years that lie ahead. If you want to stay informed, you need to write for the Plain Truth magazine every single month, and we're coming along very quickly, by the way, with a special edition on the Middle East. You'll get articles just like that. It's free of charge. There is no price whatever. We'll send it to you by return mail as soon as we receive your request. Until next time in this special series, this is Garner Ted Armstrong. Goodbye, friends.
You have seen Garner Ted Armstrong. Send your letters to Ambassador College, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Or Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, B.C.